Pop Spotting 192.
Tuesday, January 10th, 2012. Welcome to Pop Spotting. I'm Jen.
And I am Ryan.
It's TV Tuesday, and as everything winds back up after the holiday breaks, and as we get ready for a few new shows in January, we thought we'd talk about a recent discovery that's found quite a few fans among you guys.
That's right. Now, a few weeks ago, Greg Mariotti from Pixar Talk joined us on the show and gave us two recommendations that definitely made an impact in our house. First, he said that we should finally upgrade to Blu-ray, which we did for Christmas.
Yes.
And he also said that Blu-ray is the best way to experience one of his favorite shows, Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey just started its second season here in the U.S. on Sunday, so last week we mainlined the first season. Oh. We even got our daughter to watch with us, and she got hooked.
Absolutely. Now, so we wanted to talk about getting into Downton Abbey and its first season, hopefully without giving too much away in case we convince you to check it out. And of course, we want to hear from new or longtime fans as we together dive into year number two. Now, a warning, of course, season two and a Christmas special have already aired in the UK, so some of you will be way ahead of us, and you should be careful about what you Google. With that said, Jen, what is the setup for Downton Abbey?
It's a British historical period drama out of Carnival Films and ITV. It was picked up by PBS in America and aired as part of its Masterpiece series.
That's right. Now, it's largely the creation of British actor, screenwriter, and director Julian Fellowes. He wrote Gosford Park, Vanity Fair, The Tourist. He even acted in Tomorrow Never Dies, and he was also in several BBC shows.
It starts off in 1912, and it's basically about life at an aristocratic country estate in northern England.
Yes, it's about a place, it's about a space, it's certainly about a specific time. Downton Abbey is headed by the Earl and Countess of Grantham, but fortunately, the show is as much about the servants, the workers in the house, as it is about this prominent and wealthy noble family.
And there's a historical backdrop that weaves itself into the story. In the first episode, we learn about the news of the sinking of the Titanic, and the last episode kicks off at the start of the Great War, and there's just so much attention paid to costumes and sets and props and language and the protocol of the day. It's very period, but it's also a little bit soapy and very character driven and very interesting.
Well, you know, I will have to say, and certainly for anybody listening to this going, oh Lord, you know, I think I'm going to be bored out of my skull this week, I was skeptical about this show. And, you know, despite the fact that people I love and respect, like Greg and many others, said that this is something you need to check out, I'm going, Masterpiece Theater, I mean, people, yes, I mean, this show, what I remember is even my mom thinking it's for old people, you know. So do I want to watch more people in stuffy corsets and stiff upper lips with problems that we can't possibly identify with? And it is critically acclaimed. You know, it seems a lot of people who spend a lot of time, maybe more time than we do watching television, love this show. And for better or worse, sometimes that does send up warning flags for me, and or at least make me think that I need to be a little more critical. I might have even been trying to dislike it because maybe I was dreading kind of a Mad Men experience. Mad Men is a great show. It's solid. It's well done. It has a lot of fans. People I know and love like it, but I could just couldn't get into it. It actually put me to sleep, and I'm like, this just might not be the show for me. It might be Mad Men for really old rich people. So I was a little worried.
I was expecting that too, and I'm happy to say that that's not the case at all. I might have come into this show with a slightly more open mind than you, because in the past couple years, I've become a fan of like very Victorian novels like Middlemarch. I've been reading all of those, mm-hmm. and I've fallen in love with kind of the rules and the protocol and the pageantry that was in that world. And so I really got sucked into it, and I fell in love with these characters, and I hated some of these characters, and sometimes I loved them and hated them at the same time.
I agree, and you know, I'll tell you what sucked me in first. Before, I was like, I'm not sure if I'm going to care about the kind of problems rich people have. I mean, how awful it is for them to only have one maid instead of two serving mm-hmm. them, for example, and that kind of does come up, but it sucked me in very quickly on a technical standpoint, and I'm not ashamed to say it. It's a beautifully presented show. I mean, I guess it's one of the most expensive shows that this production house has ever done, and it definitely comes out on screen. It's got just really rich detail, like you mentioned, sort of not just the setting, but the costumes and the props and everything. And I was just really conscious of the use of wide-angle lenses, and it's every other shot is either from a crane that's pulling back or on a dolly shot that's sliding through a richly appointed hall. hallway. Very, very cinematic. It looks like a movie on television. It doesn't look flat or cramped at all. I mean, yes, these are people in sometimes confined spaces in this mansion, in this house, in this castle, but the settings around it, the town that they go into, the landscapes, as well as these rooms, just look great. So for a while, I might have just been paying attention to all of the trappings, and that gave me enough time to fall in love with the characters. Now, I should mention, it's filmed at an actual castle, Highclere Castle, outside of London. It was it's a Victorian castle built at least going back as far as the 1600s, and I would say that the setting is certainly a key part of the show.
As are the costumes. There's so much attention paid to the detail in the costuming, and costuming was such a big deal in Victorian England. What you wore really spoke about you, and that comes through in this show because there are so many shots of women getting dressed and so much talk about the gowns and gloves and jewelry, and all the men wear collars and cufflinks and snuff boxes. It's very ornate and very easy to get sucked into the costumes that you see on these people.
Yeah, so again, whether it's the setting, you know, this castle, the place in England that they're at, these costumes and how elaborate and ornate they are, this attention to detail. Although, you know, I was Googling about it. I mean, there's an enormous amount of fetishism and love of the costuming on this show. So there are blogs about it and everything. And there are people actually saying that, you know, this dress worn by this character previously appeared in this period movie or this period show. But in any case, so you can fall for all of that stuff. You can really immerse yourself in this detail and find all of this magic that holds you long enough, because there is a lot you need to learn about the people in Downton Abbey. It's an ensemble show. It's an enormous cast. You know, I keep going back to Lost. If you think that's a lot of people to keep track of and know, this puts it to shame. I mean, there's this enormous array of people, both on the wealthy noble side and down in the servants' quarters. Yet still, by the end of this first season, we know all of them by name. We know who they are, what they do, what motivates them, what's their conflict. And I think that's certainly a testament to how well this show is put together.
I never felt lost watching this show. I felt like everything was explained in such a way that I could understand how everything worked. I could understand which character did which job and why they couldn't go into this room and why they couldn't do that. It's so complex, but presented in such a simple way. There's so much talk of lineage and protocol, and even within the house with the servants, there are housemaids and their lady maids and their kitchen maids, and there's butlers and valets and footmen, and some of them have this job, but it never felt oppressive, and it never felt confusing.
Yeah, that's, I think, a testament to it, because even I could take a step back and take a breath and realize how ridiculous some of this is and how much things have changed since then. And, you know, why does it matter that this person can't even just bend down to pick something up because it's beneath him to do that, but he also can't do that task because he hasn't earned it yet? Why can't she enter the room until this person has left? Why do you need to dress at this time for this meal, or what does this bell mean? Or, you know, all of that stuff can seem so overwhelming and overly complex, but it never felt that way. It never felt preachy. It also never felt like they were condemning this lifestyle. They were simply presenting it, but in a way that was interesting, that I was learning all of this stuff, even though I didn't necessarily want to.
And because there's such a huge emphasis on what is said, what one character says to another, and language, it's so important. But what's more important are the things that are not said, because
right,
people didn't necessarily have an avenue to speak freely. And I think there's just so much subtlety in the act acting on the parts of the people in the production, because a lot of them really have to act with their expressions, with their eyes, because they're not allowed to say a lot of things.
Yeah, they have to convey betrayal, they have to convey attraction, even though, you know, they can't actually say these things in this polite culture. So I would agree, it's definitely about what's not said, what can't be expressed. You know, early on in the series, a great travesty, a great, you know, awful, I think, crime is sort of committed against one of the protagonists of the show, and yet he doesn't tell anybody, he doesn't say anything. In any other environment, in any other movie, you would be like, just go and tell on the guy or just say what happened, but he can't for a million reasons. So all of the things that need to be said, as you say, comes through in their facial expressions, in their movements, in their actions. I think that, you know, in the show, it's sort of upstairs, downstairs. It is sort of the divide between the noble family and the servants. They both sides have this complex structure and rules to them. I think the reason why you would say, though, maybe the servant stories are more compelling is because at least when they're down below decks, you know, when they're in their quarters doing what they do, they have more of an opportunity, I think, to speak freely. They have fewer, at least, social and political filters. So at least hearing them articulate in words what we might be thinking, what the noble family might be thinking, might make them a little more fun to watch.
But the story is largely driven by this noble family. This particular couple have three daughters and no sons, therefore no heirs. Mm-hmm. There are titles to be considered and entails on the estate inheritance, the money that these children are going to get. And the story focuses on saving Downton Abbey and keeping it in the family by legal challenge or by marriage. And the biggest burden is on Mary, the oldest daughter.
Right. And I think maybe fortunately, you can say that that aspect of this overall plot, this course of events is very familiar. It's a timeless story that's been told over and over again about making sure that these daughters are taken care of, making sure that they're married before they're too old and they lose that opportunity, or making sure that they have money to live on in their lives. If you can't get a piece of the inheritance, can they find the right guy so that they can have a future? And I kind of like the setting with that bigger picture about what women can and can't do and what opportunities are available or not available to them versus what men are allowed to do in this world.
Yeah, there is that social commentary, but I think it works well with the amount of emphasis we're given on the interpersonal drama, on the squabbles between siblings and the love. It's a really good balance, and it's definitely not as preachy as I expected. In fact, when there is commentary, it's kind of sly and kind of funny and clever. It's about how things were either better or backwards back then. In fact, there's a plot point that they get a phone in the house and they don't know how to deal with the phone, and a butler says, "It's a telephone, not a toy." And it just makes me think of how telephones are now toys and how that could be for the better or for the worse.
Well, you know, that's it. You know, now I love that you pointed that out, because where I was going to go myself is that I like that the creators of the show are not passing judgment or making fun of or giving that commentary on whether life was better or worse back then most of the time. But you've pointed a good one out there. I mean, when they talk about dealing with technology like electricity
or civil coming out in pants.
Or pants, you know, women in pants, the horror. Those are really notable. They're fun and enjoyable, but if anything, they kind of break that fourth wall for me, because I did want to give the show credit for just sort of being matter of fact in their presentation of what's going on. But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is fun as well. There is that emphasis, though, more on the interpersonal drama versus the bigger political picture or women's rights, although that is part of the plot. And I like that, because it is about these people. You care about these people, and within them, there are conspiracies and scandals and alliances and betrayals. And the reason why I like the show is because it's not cheesy. It's not a big soap opera. I mean, there is soapy stuff. It's a little bubbly, but not too much. You know, I think for the most part, the storylines are pretty taut and delicious, you know, not gaudy or ridiculous. And I give it a lot of credit for that, too.
I think the fact that news has to travel by letter and by messenger and by telegraph really adds to the drama, adds to the tension. It really makes you wonder what character knows what thing when. And I think this particular period of history is really the most interesting to explore because of the changes in technology.
Yeah, I mean, it is about that change. It is about kind of dealing with it. And as far as that bigger picture in the world they're in, it is about the aristocracy that we're seeing versus, you know, socialism and women getting the vote. And as you mentioned, the show kind of leads us up right up until the start of that first great war and how they deal with it. So, yeah, I mean, I think you said it early on. It's about the wonderful balance between the society and the world back there in 1920 and this specific family and its servants and their entanglements and relationships that makes this show work so well. Let's talk briefly, though, about some of these characters, because the show is about them. It's about, for example, the head of the household. You've got Robert Crowley, played by Hugh Bonneville. He's the Earl of Grantham, and his wife, Cora, the Countess of Grantham, played by Elizabeth Cora. I mean, these two pretty much preside guide over all the adventures at Downton Abbey.
They seem to have a really great relationship, but what I like about the Earl is that he's almost unreasonably cool. You know, he takes things in stride. He doesn't fire his employees unless they really, really, truly deserve it. And he loves his wife, and he seems to defer to her in most discussions.
Yeah, I like the depiction of their marriage. I like their relationship. But I would agree that if you're going to say anything, you know, uncomplimentary about the character, I mean, I like the performances, but the thing about the Earl is that you're right. He takes everything in stride so that when you have this supposed tension that somebody's going to get fired or in trouble or some great justice will be beset them because of what they've done in his house, and it turns out that he's, you know, he just kind of has this look, he has this pause, and he's like, oh, well, you know, we'll work around that. I think that if anything, he's a little unrealistic because he's such a great guy in this time period that he might be a little more modern for the world that he's living in. But the show is about the daughters too. We can talk about them. The eldest daughter, as we mentioned, Mary, Lady Mary Crawley, played by Michelle Dockery. And then you've got the middle sister, Laura Carmichael, playing Edith, and Jessica Brown Findlay playing Sybil, the youngest daughter. And sort of the interplay and the rivalries between these sisters is just fantastic.
They're all very different women. It's hard to believe that they were all raised by the same set of people. I think my favorite sister is Lady Sybil, because for lack of a better word, she's spunky. You know, she's very independent, but she's also helpful and kind and aims to please. But the most interesting sister maybe is Michelle Dockery playing Lady Mary, because Lady Mary, I don't know what to make of her. She's immensely unlikable, but I also have a soft spot for her because of the really? Challenges that she faces. I mean, she's in love, but she can't do anything about it because of the social mores of the day.
Well, you know, she's in the toughest spot as the eldest daughter who has to get pushed out of the nest first. She's the closest to potentially inheriting, but can't for a variety of reasons. I can see why Lady Sybil is your favorite. I mean, certainly the baby of the family is maybe going to be the toughest one, the one that's going to try the hardest. But the rivalry between Lady Mary, the oldest one, and the middle daughter is, I think, the one that's the soapiest. It's the most, you know, oh, no, you didn't. You know, mm-hmm. The two of them, just watching the two of them go at it and fighting each other and sabotaging each other, it's great to watch. The Noble family is much larger. There's more characters. You had Matthew Crawley, sort of the love interest slash potential rival to the head of this estate, played by Dan Stevens. He's not bad, but we have to mention before we get to the servants, Violet, the mother, the grandmother, the Countess of Grantham, played by the spectacular Maggie Smith.
She's amazing. Violet is such a hateful person, but Maggie Smith, the delivery of her lines and the look in her eyes occasionally, just it cracks me up. I think she's doing a fantastic job.
Well, she gets certainly some of the best lines, and you're right. You can't believe the things that come out of her mouth, but because it's Maggie Smith, because it's that lovable character from Harry Potter or something.
She's McGonagall.
Yeah, you just gotta love her. But so while all of this is happening upstairs, you've got all of this drama also happening downstairs. You've got housemaids and kitchen maids and lady maids and valets and butlers and chauffeurs and, you know, just this great ecosystem there as well. And I think some of my favorite characters. Now, the story down there kind of picks up with the arrival of a new valet for the head of the household, John Bates, played by Brendan Coyle. And I don't think accidentally he is set up as sort of the anti-hero of the lower levels of this household.
I have a little crush on Mr. Bates.
Well, I don't think you're alone. I mean, he's a father figure, a handsome guy, but, you know, with a troubled past. He's absolutely compelling. You've got kind of the butler that runs everything, Carson, played by Jim Carter. I think he's great. You have Mrs. Hughes, the head housekeeper on the women's side, played by Phyllis Logan. And I think she has one of the more interesting story arcs in the first season. She goes from just sort of being this, you know, dowdy boss lady to being more romantic, more sympathetic. So I think that she's great too.
I think Carson and Mrs. Hughes are both very interesting because when we meet them, they seem very stern and not very likable, but we see them together and they seem to have a really great friendship, but also downstairs, just like upstairs, there are villains. There are villains downstairs too. And Siobhan Finneran plays Sarah O'Brien and Rob James Collier plays Thomas Barrow. And they're a wonderful, dastardly team. Thomas is very ambitious, but he's also vicious, and I really, I don't, I think he's going to go to any lengths he can to achieve what he wants. And at the same time, I think he's really corrupted some of the other characters. I think Sarah O'Brien is probably not a bad person on her own, but I think she's really been kind of seduced by Thomas.
Well, they are both deliciously bad, bad guys in terms of their plotting and conspiring and try to bringing down people and hurting people. I think that O'Brien, I liked where the season ended with her, where on one hand, she's done perhaps the most awful, awful, awful thing, but she's the closest one, I think, to turning a corner. Whereas I think it was Thomas's storyline that I was, of all of the characters' storyline, I was the least satisfied with, because I'm not sure where they were going with that. And, you know, when you've got a good bad guy, when you've got a really good bad guy, what you want is the payoff, you know, something mm-hmm. to happen to them. And I guess if anything, we can say that that we certainly want to see more with Thomas and O'Brien there in season two. But there are many, many more characters. I mean, you talk about corrupting. You have the young girl played by Sophie McShera. She plays
Daisy.
Daisy, the kitchen maid. Really, really fun character. Really sweet character. Not the brightest bulb, but probably the most lovable character.
I fear for Daisy because I feel she has the most to lose. And she's also gullible and suggestible. We've already seen her under Thomas's sway.
Right.
Who's to say what's next for Daisy? I think there might be something even worse lurking around the corner for her.
And just like upstairs, you have downstairs kind of romantic rivalries and tensions and budding relationships. So, you know, Thomas is kind of up against the other footman, William, played by Thomas Howes. And there's a head housemaid, Anna. And she develops kind of a crush, kind of this budding relationship. And I think that without giving too much away, you know, her performance, Joanna Froggatt, the way that she's drawn to this person, she's, you know, kind of starry-eyed about it, but then also determined to understand him and get to know what's going on with this man. I think that if there's a romantic relationship, as much fun as seeing Mary and the sisters fight over men, I think it's that relationship downstairs that, if I'm a shipper, I'm an Anna shipper, I guess.
You're a Banna.
Yes. So, Downton Abbey, again, we're just going by the first season out on streaming and DVD and Blu-ray, and they just aired the season premiere of the second season on PBS. Were you satisfied, though, with season one? Are you that much more interested in seeing where the story goes?
I can't wait to see how this season unfolds. It sucked me in a way that I could not have anticipated, and I love it.
Well, I do, too. I am completely hooked to this British period drama. As we mentioned, season two just started airing in the U.S. on PBS on Sunday nights, but you can catch up with the first season that we just discussed here. It is available on DVD, Blu-ray, and Netflix streaming, but as our pusher Greg Mariotti advised, make sure you go Blu-ray or at least research what you're watching, because the series was edited a bit when it was aired on PBS, and you want to be sure that you get everything. You get the whole story in the right order. Now, we had to caution that because season two has already aired in the U.K., even a Christmas special that even comes years beyond the second season, be careful what you read and watch online. We will be watching season two with the rest of the country and possibly checking in with our thoughts in a few weeks. But of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on Downton Abbey as well.
So tell us, are you smitten with Downton Abbey, or could you just not get into the melodrama of a lot of old people with a lot of money and free time? Is there another masterpiece we should check out instead?
That's right. We want to talk about what you want to talk about. So please never hold back on telling us what you're watching and what you think about it.
You can drop us an email at feedback@popspotting.net. You can comment on the blog at popspotting.net, or you can call us at 815-310-0808.
Tune in tomorrow for Wild Card Wednesday, but we want to say thanks to Dan Pashman of The Sporkful for making our theme song, and we want to say mahalo anui loa to you for listening to our little show.
For Pop Spotting, I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
Aloha.
Aloha.